Oh, you're back, Mark. Did you manage to find any guests for the podcast?
Two bush dwellers.
Australians? Oh, excellent. Let me see who they are. Oh, the 42 to Doomsday boys? No, they won't do. Their craniums are too narrow. Their cerebrum's underdeveloped.
But the big head's not come, Doc. Not to diddly-dum.
They must, Mark. One day, a true intelligent species. What are you doing?
Just looking for something to drink.
You're lying. You can't deceive me, Mark. You've been looking for Hayden again, haven't you? I've told you before, you get Hayden back when his children have grown up and left home. All right? Who's that at the door?
Can you spare a glass of water?
Can we come in?
Humans. At last, humans.
Well, as close as we're likely to get.
My dear sirs, you've no idea what a pleasure this is. It's so long since we've... Mark, help them with their coats and their hats.
Well, if we could just get shelter for a while.
Great heavens, you can't go walking on a night like this. I wouldn't dream of letting you proceed one step further. Don't stir yourself, Mark. Our guests are old and wet. Sorry, our guests are cold and wet. Let me take your hat, sir.
Oh, what a magnificent head.
What?
Superb head.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
These two might do, Mark. We need someone with a rotten big jammy head to replace Hayden.
Oh.
We were just on our way to LA for Galley.
Oh, how very jammy. Wait a minute.
What surly hosts you must think us. Please, come in. Make yourselves at home. Warm yourselves and sit down. Mark, pour the dandelion and burdock.
Oh, it's very kind of you. What are those clay busts?
You seem very keen on heads, Mr...
Whom?
Whom?
Doc Whom. Yes, we're trying to come up with the perfect head for the new podcast host we're building down in the basement. But unfortunately, this isn't a very good example. I'll cover this up.
I thought I recognised the face. A sort of ginger Hagrid.
You're mistaken. Here we are now.
Ah, let's hope that Mark has brought something special. Mark, how many times have I told you the dandelion and burdock must be opened and allowed to breathe? So would you please do as you've been instructed? Wink.
Something wrong with your eye, Doctor Whom? Who's your friend?
Oh, that's Mark. He's an excellent fellow, very devoted to the podcast. Many years ago, I dragged him from the wreck of a Facebook conversation. And, well... lobotomy was the only way of saving his life, unfortunately. Your accents are familiar. One never really overcomes the nostalgia for one's city of origin. Sometimes I look up at the sky and I think, what's that big shiny yellow orb? And will I ever see Manchester again?
You're missing nothing.
What?
He said it's really buzzing these days. What makes you settle in Mummerset?
The general absence of fans. Gatekeeping jealousy. I just had to get away.
I know who that reminds me of now. The Rev. One of the most despicable, criminally minded wretches that ever lived.
There are some of us who would not agree with that, gentlemen.
Not many, but we can't afford to be too fussy in choosing co-hosts.
Just to warn you in advance, faithless listeners, that some of the audio on this podcast isn't of top quality, but it does tend to improve a bit later on into the podcast. We had technical issues and bronchial issues. Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 193 of the Diddly Dumb podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Mark.
I'm Gareth.
And I'm Ian.
Hey, welcome.
Hurrah! Astonishing as it may come to us, as it may seem to you listeners, we do actually know who our guests are. Our guests are, of course, Gareth, for it is he, Cavanna, and Ian, for it is he, Winterton, of Vwarp Vwarp magazine and Cutaway Comics, Cutaway Almost Anything these days, fame. Welcome, chaps. I trust you've all been healthy over Christmas and New Year.
No, I've been very ill.
Oh.
We should probably point out, because I'm almost guaranteed to start coughing again. Yeah, I started getting ill on Christmas Eve, and then I thought it was COVID. It wasn't COVID, and it just wouldn't go away. And I ended up on antibiotics because I had beginnings of pneumonia. And apparently it's called the 100-day cough, and everyone's getting it up north.
You need the lungs of a beer straw with a methane filter.
But I'm getting better, and although I've had a really, really crap January, or most of January, I'm ready for LA, but I've also just come back from that London yesterday, which I can tell you about later on.
Well, I think if we've got a terrible disease over here, it's only fair of us to spread it across the Atlantic. I mean, things haven't been too good for me. Today, I travelled all the way to Reigate for a job I was after at Donabys. You know, the big rocket components manufacturer? Only to find they'd already given it to a nephew of one of the bloody directors.
Oh.
I wouldn't mind, but it was only as a tea lady.
Don't tell me you tore your best sports jacket as well.
My best sports jacket. Those lines sounded quite familiar.
That's dialogue from the free DVD that came with the latest issue of Vwarp Vwarp magazine, I believe.
Yes. Yes, it's David Whittaker's... The bit I decided to use as a voiceover. So, so we just thought, it's either going to have a voiceover all the way through it, which will make this thing tedious, probably, and also even longer than it was going to be. And then I thought, no, we'll just have it at the beginning, and then we'll cut off in a sort of pre-credits sort of moment. And when we get to that bit, we'll have no more voiceover. So that seemed to be, I did love all that. It was lovely, juicy, from that sort of early 60s bed-sitting land. Kind of, you know, how people lived in those days. I was talking to my mum because she was in London from Derby, living in bedsits, but with landlords and landladies that cut your tea and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, you are tempted to wonder, if Ian's only living in digs with a landlady, just how many sports jackets does he have that he's able to grade them so precisely? This was the best of my multiple sports jackets. It's like, how many different types of towels does Monica have in Friends?
That was how life was in the early 60s, with the smog.
This is, of course, a meeting on the common.
Yeah, I think the smog and the fog's beautifully rendered in the animation, I have to say. The lighting is incredible. Is it Mel Meanley?
Oh, such a talent.
I mean,
17 when he started that. He's, you know, he's got an entire career ahead of him, a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
He's unlike any 18-year-old I can think of. You know, I tell you what, he takes no prisoners. He knows exactly what he wants. I hope he goes on to have a big career, because, my God, he deserves it.
Oh, I think he will. It was amazing. We took him on, and then we were like, oh, he said, well, we'll just have to, I'll start as soon as I finish my A-levels. That's literally what stage of life he was at. It was... I better do some revision, and then I'll get on with this amazing stuff. Oh. He's at a professional level, you know, just dealing with him, all his, the way he discusses story, the way he did sound, and then of course all the animation on top of all that, the sort of main meat and potatoes. But he's I'd be surprised if, like a lot of people who start off on the fan sites, he doesn't, like the guys who did all the colorization on the Daleks, for instance. They all started off doing it for fun, didn't they?
Oh, is that Rich Tipple? And
Yeah. So I'd be surprised if he wasn't sort of snapped up at some point to do something huge and professional.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't realise he was that young, actually. So how old would he have been when he did the Celestial Toymaker then?
17. Using a mocap suit that he bought off Amazon.
Huh? Wow.
Real homemade, can-do it's where fanzines came from. It's where all that, you know, original audio. Yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. I've no doubt we'll be working for him, making his tea in 10 years' time.
Well, what we'd really like is to get another project out of him, but we shall see, because
he's in demand already, I think.
Let's see, I bet he is. It just looks great. Like I say, it's marvellously moody, and the way he's done the lighting effects, like when the Doctor's lighting his magic match and stuff, it's really remarkable.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suppose we've got to say, the other side to the magic is the incredible voice cast that we assembled.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I've watched that lots of times now for various reasons, and bloody hell, they're all on their marks. I mean, all of them. Even, you know, Kerry, we added this just, you know, right at the end of the process. They're all on their marks. Steve Noonan, who we met in Gallifrey last year and had a chat with him, you know, and heard a lot about his passion for the show, because he'd been sold, I think, unfortunately, as if he'd just dropped in from, you know, the RSC to do a little bit of this year Doctor Who, and it's nonsense. He's a, you know, he's an absolute dyed-in-the-wool avid fan, you know, precious thing kid with the, you know, the Radio Times 10th anniversary, you know, he knows all of the lore, chapter and verse, and watching him script that first Doctor, but doing a little bit different, a little bit almost like he is in the pilot. And he was bloody good, wasn't he?
Oh, good, he's amazing. He's absolutely lovely bloke as well. But yeah, he just knows Hartnell. He's just absorbed his life now. I mean, I loved him in everything. I love him in Big Finish, but it was just especially, you know, that little bit where he knew exactly how Hartnell's voice would be for the little radio introduction bits, you know, the promo bit that he did that doesn't exist anymore. But we did it.
Right, that was you just had a script for an original radio broadcast radio advert that went out on BBC.
Yeah, coming up, I'll be appearing as the Doctor in Doctor Who, kind of thing. But he knew exactly how his voice would be doing that job, not as the Doctor, but as William Hartnell. So that, you know, all the thought that went into that is quite remarkable. He really is.
Yeah, that first Doctor's really malevolent, isn't he?
Yeah.
But then on the other side, you know, for Ian and Barbara, Ian in particular, we weren't looking for someone to do a sort of Ian sound alike. It was someone that had to, Adam just occupied that sort of decent chap, Red Brick University, sort of solid fellow place that he brought to his performance. But it wasn't, we weren't looking for a sound alike with him, but just someone who felt that he inhabited the same place. He was brilliant. They were all brilliant to work with, and I'm very proud of what we did with that.
Adam, we've worked with before, and one of the play, he worked on a play of mine, which was set in the Antarctic in 62. 61 to 62. So I knew he could do like that incredibly posh BBC voice that everyone spoke in those days. And so he was just like the first person I thought of.
It's RP, but it's sort of Ken Barlow off Coronation Street in the 60s RP. So it's, unfortunately, like everything we do with Warp Warp, it's a one-off, you know. So everyone now has an alternate opening to the show if things go on, and we have to wait until An Unearthly Child is public domain in 2047 or whatever.
It's an adaptation of the opening chapter of David Whittaker's 1964 novel, Doctor Who and an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks, which is most people listening to this podcast may already know anyway, was the alternative how Ian and Barbara met. And Ian's not a teacher, he's a scientist, and he's just been turned down for a job at Donnerby's. And it has that thing that's very common to Whittaker when you get into him, that it's like bloody nepotism, bloody old boys network. Yeah, so he's really quite a grumpy man, Ian. And then obviously he meets Barbara at a horrific car crash with a dead soldier in an army lorry, and Susan's been left by the side of the road bleeding from her head wound, and it's very bizarre. And then when you meet the Doctor, he's got this everlasting match.
I don't remember that from the book.
No, it's in the book. That was the first thing Steve Noonan said. He said, the everlasting match has got to be in it. And we went, of course.
It's essentially what we think of as the Barnes Common scene, isn't it, intro?
Yeah.
To the Daleks. Called A Meeting on the Common, which I think is brilliant marketing, because as we all know, the one thing that every Doctor Who fan loves is a bit of common. He's always seemed to me as one of the most under-celebrated contributors to Doctor Who, David Whittaker. He was doing the Daleks comic strip as well, wasn't he, at one point?
Yeah. I mean, we could probably put in a plug for a friend of Thorpe's, Simon Guerrier's amazing book on David Whittaker, which is came out a few months ago, didn't it?
Is that an exciting adventure with David Whittaker?
Yes.
It is. It's an amazing deep dive into a guy who's he's not interviewed, because we think that the interview that he does in Doctor Who magazine is a fake. So his voice just isn't there. And he's sort of he's gently forgotten. And Simon brilliantly goes into this. And it would appear that he manages to get himself thoroughly blacklisted on the back of a Writers Guild trip to the USSR in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes! As I recall, it's David Whittaker was chairman of the British Writers Guild in the late 60s. And there was an, I think there was a conference in Moscow of the International Writers Guild at the end of the 60s. And the British Guild didn't want to send representatives to this conference because it was around about that time that Solzhenitsyn had been thrown out of the Russian Guild. And his works were being censored. And then there were some other people saying, no, we should go, but we should make a strong statement against censorship. So they voted to send delegates. And then, so David Whittaker turns up in Moscow. And instead of making a speech attacking the USSR, he makes a speech in which his example of the sort of censorship they should be fighting against was McCarthyism in the United States, which seems very much like a way of getting the Russian guild off the hook, because they could obviously support criticism of the United States, whereas they wouldn't be able to support criticism of the USSR. So David Whittaker ends with, and this is why, and this sort of McCarthyism is why we should oppose censorship worldwide. And then the Russian delegates demanded that he withdrew his speech or they'd leave the conference. And they had a vote on it. I think, was it only the Brits and the Israelis voted in favour of debating the censorship issue. And so the Brits and the Israelis then threatened, well, if you refuse to debate this, we'll go home. And so the only way they could get us to stay at the conference was to agree to issue a statement attacking censorship. And so David Whittaker gets back to Britain and he says to the British Guild, oh, look what we've done. We've managed to get even the Russians to agree to a strong statement against censorship worldwide. And I think we should support this. And if any other guild in the world refuses to support it, the British Guild should pull out of the International Guild as a sign of solidarity. And he got a ton of hate mail for it. Lord knows why. Possibly because the only statement against censorship that he could get out of this International Guild was one, a general one about censorship worldwide, rather than specifically aimed at, targeted at Russia. I don't know. But it all seems rather barking in the extreme. But not no surprise from her. A time when, probably around about this time, Malcolm Hulk was probably busy being thrown out of the Communist Party of Great Britain for the 17th time for being insufficiently pure. there we are. When I was saying all that, I was just thinking to myself, how on earth do I know all this? And then midway the penny dropped that I think when I was researching for our review of Ambassadors of Death a few months ago, I was looking for stuff on David Whittaker, and I came across a very long piece about this very issue, either in DWM or in Essential Doctor Who, by Simon Guerrier himself. So, well done, Simon.
Can I just say, if any of the listeners are thinking that there's any sort of sound quality problems with Gareth's voice, it's because he's we've actually got his brain in a tank wired up.
Can you see anything, Gareth?
Like a sponge under the sea. If you can top my tank up with a fine pint of Timmy Taylor's Landlord, then I'm sure I'll be fine. I won't notice it.
I thought there was a nice head at the top of that tank. It was just...
Yeah, so poor David Whittaker, he's unfortunate. And speaking to Simon, you know, the work dries up, the BBC don't want to know him. He moves to Australia. He becomes the guy who teaches people to write in Australia. It's a sad ending in that way.
I presume we don't mean from scratch.
the whole country.
Yeah, there's a lovely article, isn't there, by Simon Guerrier on David Whittaker in the latest issue of Warp as well.
I love the fact that there are still these massive figures that we know comparatively little about. Or we don't have any, you know, we only seem to have like one picture of Mervyn Pinfield and there's no interviews with Mervyn Pinfield. You know, I like those little niches out there. That's kind of what we're about with Warp, is finding ridiculous little symbols of own knowledge and turning it into a...
Yeah, that's what I love about it. Stuff that even if you're a big Doctor Who fan, you're probably reading about stuff you haven't read about before. It's not entry-level Who fandom, Vorp, is it?
No, I mean, the comic strips as well have all sorts of references and things in that, unless you're, you know, very much steeped in the show, that you're not really going to pick up on, you know, that you're not going to get all the references and stuff, are you?
No, no. Well, having said that, there's the interviews of Bart Gatiss and Brian Cox, anyone who's knows about An Adventure in Space and Time, we'll be able to enjoy those. So that's positively populist.
That was interesting. I had no idea that Cox had worked with Newman.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Year of the Sex Olympics. Well, sort of. I think they're kind of adjacent at the time. He talks about bumping into him. So I guess Sydney was on his way out by then, 1967, 68. Seems to have a very, you know, very end for him at the BBC.
So many people.
I remember Gary Russell telling me, he said, the thing about the BBC is, no matter how much you love it, it will never love you back in the same way. The best you can hope for is a quick smog and a fumble down the back alley.
What you're saying about finding niches, Gareth, as well, you've really gone above and beyond with the article on Reg Cranfield and Fred Rawlings, who the extras who played the policeman at the start of the pilot episode and the actual broadcast episode as well.
That was Colin Brockhurst at his finest, the proper bloodhound. I mean, God, at one point, we were asking people who we sort of knew who might have lived in villages. Because all that was out there on Reg Cranfield was a couple of erroneous lines on IMDb that turned out to be completely untrue. And then it turned out that there were God knows how many Reg Cranfields knocking around, you know, in the sort of mid half of the 20th century. Reg Cranfield is a surprisingly popular name. Yeah, I mean, fair dues to Colin. That was an epic piece of research. And the sort of thing that BWM probably couldn't or wouldn't do, which I suppose is what we thought.
Talking of Mel Meanley, the animator, which I have to say, no disrespect intended towards Mel, but Mel Meanley is a name which irresistibly reminds me of Sylvester Sneakley, the baddie in The Perils of Penelope Pitstop.
Penelope Pitstop, heiress to a vast fortune, is in perpetual peril from her fortune-seeking guardian, Sylvester Sneakley, who, unknown to her, is really the Hooded Claw. But foiling this fiend's foul plots are Penelope's ever-present protectors, the Antill Mob.
I'll get you, Penelope Pitstop.
Do you think this home animation is something that's likely to take off in an increasingly big way?
Well, there's already quite a lot of YouTubers who are sort of doing this sort of thing in the fan community. But it is really like, I don't know, I was going to use the word punk, but that probably is the wrong. But it is the fact that they can, you need a really good computer. So I suppose it's not quite like buying a 5-quid guitar and an amp. But you need a good computer, but then you can do everything. He just did everything himself in his room.
That's a very good piece at the beginning. Is it Warp 6, this?
Yeah.
There's a very good piece at the beginning by Matt Charlton, spinster of this parish, about how it's put together. I thought it was interesting, because I just read something about this the previous day, we'd taken on board some of the criticism of Toymaker. Was that about the animation of it?
Yeah.
It's not just the general criticism that it's all part of Gary Russell's plot to take over the world.
Poor Gary. Yeah. You know, more sinned against than sinner. No, I think he would have been referring to, because I don't think he had seen the Toymaker. He was talking about his animation of part one.
Not the official one that's coming out.
No, because I don't think we'd seen it.
No.
We hadn't seen it, so I don't think that was released, because we were writing all this in probably late October. I mean, Mel's part one, it's an extraordinary piece.
Oh, it's great.
But, again, and, you know, we know the debate is out there. There are the hardcore Gen 1 fans like Ian Levine, especially Ian Levine, who want it to look exactly as they remember it in 1966. And then there's the other side, which I've got to say I'm more in tune with, which is, we've got the soundtrack, let's do a completely new presentation of the material, and let's make it more expansive and more fun and more creative. And I think that's more interesting. The worst animation, I think, is, I mean, and I know there's a bit of debate about which is the worst, but it's the Ice Warriors 2 and 3 for me, which were done slavishly to match the camera scripts, to match the tele snaps, and it's small and boring and unadventurous. But yes, I suppose it's got to fill a gap to the other four, so it's got to fit in. But if you've got something like Marco Polo or The Massacre, where you have nothing, you have no moving footage, you might as well do something interesting. You don't want to animate the sellotape guys on the extras in Marco Polo, or, you know, the dodgy bits of Maker. Want it expansive.
Yeah, I said that as a joke to somebody online. Oh, I suppose you want these yellow, these sellotape back on the, on the yellow face actor's eyes, and he was like, yes, you know, I want it to be exactly what it was. So it's just like Jesus, but I just think it's bizarre.
It is bizarre. It seems that I'll be quite happy when it's finally done and we get expansive shots of Paris and all kinds of lovely things. That's what I want out. That's what makes me want to happily hand over £20 and maybe go watch it at the BFI.
I think The Macroterror is probably one of my favourites and probably most successful. I think it stays fairly faithful. Obviously, it famously doesn't have the scene with the whatchamacallit machine. but, you know, I just think as far as kind of how much it diverges from the script, I think it's fine. You know, how much it diverges from what would have been seen on television. It looks great.
Just financially, like, these things, even, like, reconstructed with a modern audience in mind, they're not, like, the hugest sellers. You know, they just about wash their own face. So the idea that they would go, let's make something that's so faithful that it will alienate almost everybody apart from hardcore Doctor Who fans, there's just no, you know, who's going to pay for that?
So are they planning to animate the Mythmakers? It's just that you were talking about expansive views of Paris.
Oh, God, you see, I'm so slow. The big head's not come, Master. Not a diddly dum.
Going back to the magazine, because I'm quite tempted when I'm flicking through these magazines to buy myself a second copy, because a lot of these full-page artworks that you do, that you put in here, are absolutely gorgeous. I'm looking at Ian Clarke's Barbara stepping into the TARDIS with the Doctor looming in the dark behind her. The B. Garrido's brilliant portrait of Carol Ann Ford as Susan as well. And these would look great as prints framed. Well, I mean, I know you can buy them from the artist sometimes, can't you? You can certainly get prints from B. Garrido of her stuff. But I'd love to get some. You always manage to source brilliant artwork.
Well, I mean, again, you know, full credit here to Colin. He's on the money. And we're always looking out for people for cutaway comics as well. So we've got, and, you know, without Vought Vought, cutaway comics doesn't happen. Because without that fantastic contact book that Vought Vought provided, you know, the fact that we could sort to artists and we could show them Vought Vought, say, this is the level we work at, it has helped a lot. Yeah, I mean, it's... It's a beautiful artifact. You know, we get asked fairly often, why are we only a physical copy? Mostly by, you know, upset people overseas in particular who don't want to pay the postage, and I get that. But the fact is, it is designed to be a physical artifact with, like you say, beautiful full page art, things that you just wouldn't do in any other setting. And but yeah, art is very much there. And yeah, Colin just keeps unearthing these incredible gems. God knows where he gets them from. I think he's literally scouring everywhere, forums, Flickr. He is out there like a really, a really engaged, clever condo looking for the best scraps in the out there in the junkyard.
I really like the comic strip The Night Before as well, story by Tim Quinn, art by Tim Keeble. The art's excellent. I love it. It's the Beatles appear in it and they look fantastic. It's great.
Yeah, it's a bit like the cartoon 60s Beatles, don't they? I mean,
yes.
I don't mind saying I was a little bit worried about that when it was pitched, because I did think, if we get wrong tonally, it could be horrible. And I had no reason to worry once I saw it. It's like, yeah, they've nailed it right. And the fact, yeah, I mean, it was just that decision to go in that ultra stylized, almost like that 60s cartoon, was just right. It was good. And of course, we've got the Beatles coming for real this year.
Yes, I see people getting upset online about that as well, because the Beatles wouldn't have been using those pickups on that sort of Rickenbacker guitar in that year. That's ridiculous. They weren't available for another 6 months.
Beatles fans and Doctor Who fans share a lot of similarities.
I think that's just fandom generally, isn't it? Really, it just attracts the worst people like us.
If only there had been a universally agreed golden age of Doctor Who, when fans were all in harmony, or at least weren't easily able to interact with each other. Perhaps such an era might have occurred under the reign of a little-known young producer. If only we knew more about him. If only we could access a wealth of information on him. What say you, Marco?
If only there was a lavish tome on that little-known character from Doctor Who's past there, Philip Hinchcliffe. If only there was some, I don't know, authoritative book of essays and stuff that was available for people to read about him.
There's definitely a gap in the market that somebody should fill.
There is. So I'm going to do that trick that they do in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I'm going to pull back in time a glowing review of the Hinchcliffe book and commission and write that book myself.
Wait a minute. Is it just possible that all these artless references are all leading in the direction of the Philip Hinchcliffe years, the DNA of Doctor Who? What do you have to tell us, Gareth?
A beautiful Hinchcliffe book. Well in preparation, actually. Should be out in May, I think. So this is a project that has had a bloody long gestation, I'll be quite honest, and it's been through many different forms. It started out as an update of the Wigglesford book back in 2016, and that didn't happen. Then it started out as a brand new book about Philip's time. Then it turned into a biography. Then Philip decided he didn't want a biography writing because he didn't want the focus to be on him, but the art. So then we moved from the biography into this thematic essay. So there's 18 essays by the cream of established fan writers, which looked at a different aspect of Doctor Who and Philip's time, all edited by the great Gary Russell, designed by Will Brooks, beautiful art prints, full of VAM discs as well, because you know we love our VAM discs at Cutaway. So we're putting that together. It's going to be very nice, and it's going to kick off a whole series of new books that look at other producers and creatives in Doctor Who, and they get the treatment.
Full of what, did you say?
In the world.
Full of something, because, as you know, we love our something at Cutaway.
We love our VAM discs, value-added material. So commentary, DVD commentaries, documentaries.
Is there a DVD with it?
So there's a standard DVD, which is lovely. So you get a full interview, which we had Justin Johnson in the chair for from the BFI in Manchester at the beginning of January at the Anthony Burgess Institute. That's on there. There is a little documentary that we did at Derby's Hooverville last year, where we basically just sat people down and just said, what do you love about the Philip Hinchcliffe era? That was good. And that's completed on the standard disc with, we've got it in the can this week, actually. A brand new Coventry for Genesis and Daleks with Philip, who didn't do, it's the only one of his he never did on the original run of DVDs and Blu-rays. And George Galaccio, who is his production unit manager, who's brilliant. So the two of them just really talking about how TV was made, and everything is in there from, about, wiping documents and how tape wipe was authorized and how that came into the office due to how much you have to pay actors and how you book them and how you do all these things. Lots of great stuff about when Philip first started and, how close we were to getting Mr. Pastry as the doctor. All kinds of great stuff. The pastry doctor, I think, is insane, you know, but it seems that that was a very seriously considered thing.
I think the entire Vorp should be dedicated to the parallel universe where we had the pastry doctor.
There is a bit in the new magazine, isn't there, with the pastry doctor, I believe.
We love the pastry doctor. There's a brilliant clip on
Dr. Pastry
of Mr. Pastry doing a turn on the good old days in the Leeds Variety Theatre.
A turn.
Right. Yeah, he really is a turn. I can sort of see the logic. They were thinking, well, he's a kids' entertainer, good with kids. People have heard of him. Parents will have heard of the great Mr. Pastry from the 50s. And wouldn't this be marvellous? But he's going to be a bit useless at running around and knocking people out. So we'll cast that lovely Ian Marta for thumping and knocking out duty. And let's see where we end up. It would have been pretty dreadful.
I mean, what would have happened? Would that have been the end of Doctor Who, do we think?
What?
If we hadn't had Tom and we'd had Mr. Pastry instead. It's a funny idea, isn't it?
Mr. Pastry would have been shuffled out the door on his second season. But I think Philip would have gone, no. But we would have then got a Philip regeneration story. So if you could imagine the deadly assassin with Mr. Pastry. You know, it's a rich brew, isn't it? Of what if energy. I think Doctor Who would have been in bad shape. Mm. By the time, 2 years of Mr. Pastry would have been, yeah. It's amazing.
But that nearly happened without Hinchcliffe's sort of say-so. It wasn't his decision, was it?
This is also the insane thing, you know, that, and in fact, it's happened with virtually every single Doctor before that, because it's the outgoing producer who cast. Barry Letts doesn't pick Don Pertwee. I mean, yes, it worked, but he doesn't pick it. Innes Lloyd, yes, I suppose he selects Patrick Troughton, but then, no, I think Sidney Newman probably picks him out the fire.
Mm.
You know, so the producers aren't used to picking their own Doctor until JNT turns up and he picks three.
Yeah, it's mad when you think about it.
Pastry who? I mean, God. Yeah, I think it would have been in big trouble, because I think after Pastry, they might have doubled down and gone for another comedy actor. He's just a bit old. We need a younger comedy actor.
Maybe for people, because I didn't really know much about Mr. Pastry, maybe for the people that might be going, who's Mr. Pastry? Like, maybe explain who he was.
He is basically a comedian who plays himself. So he's the closest thing out there would be Norman Wisdom in the way that he's in films, but it's always awkward. You know, whether he's fighting Flash Gordon on Mars or working in a plug factory, it's always Norman Wisdom. And that's Mr. Pastry. You know, he was a physical clown. He was, but he was a very old school. You know, it was old in the 60s. So it's a very odd choice.
Yeah.
Well, he also died in 1979. So that would have been a regeneration, whether he was going to get shuffled off or not, because he got shuffled off big time.
Whose decision was it to consider him?
I'm guessing that is from Head of Drama. So that would have been Bill Slater or Ronnie Marsh, who was the outgoing Head of Drama. It'll be someone at that level.
So who would have been able to overrule them and say, no, it's going to be Tom Baker?
Well, apparently, Richard Hearn blew it himself in the interview, because in the later interviews, he was saying, when they were talking about the stories and how they were going to do it, it was, well, I don't think Mr. Pastry would do that. And they were going, well, we haven't cast Mr. Pastry as Doctor Who. We have cast Richard Hearn as Doctor Who. Yes, but I think Mr. Pastry, you know, would do this. So that apparently, when the alarm bell's ringing, oh my God. I was lucky enough to have 2 hours sat with Tom Baker about 5 years ago. And I was there riding shotgun on a private signing, and we went down to Rye, and it was at this beautiful hotel and pub called The Mermaid. And we just had like a private chat. So we were doing private signing. And so I got to ask him everything. And I was lucky that I was introduced to Tom as, oh, this is Gareth. He's just been producing a bit of theatre with Philip Hinchcliffe. So I was like, I was golden. It's like, oh, I'm a proper professional, not one of these hideous fanboys. So we had to chat about theatre for about 3/4 of an hour, and then I was able to ask him Doctor Who questions. You know, in that kind of, you know, there's a sort of ritual to these things.
Yes.
And I asked him about all these things, and I said, bloody hell, you know, so we talked about the mythical building sites that he was on, and I said, it was a hell of a thing, really. And he says, it was. It was. And so he said he had written that he was skint. He was living in a squat, had no heating, just basically living out of a bag with a mattress and going to this building site every day. And he basically did his, it's like the Widnail speak, you know, reduced, of a trained actor, reduced the status of a bum. And he wrote Bill Slater a letter saying, look, you know, I'm reduced to the status of a bum, this is ludicrous. And he said in several bits of luck that I never realized, then clicked in. And said, I had no idea that Bill Slater was new. I knew he was due in post as the head of drama, but he'd literally just started. He said, I had no idea that he was looking to cast the Doctor. He said, I also had no idea that he was struggling to come up with a name and he was under pressure. And this is maybe where Mr. Pastry comes in, because he came in and he couldn't think of anyone who could throw in the pot. And he was looking a little stupid. And through a stroke of luck, because back in those days, they had second post, which seemed ludicrous, you know. He went to check his in-tray, Bill Slater, before he went home on the Friday, thinking, Christ, who am I going to throw into the pot here? Takes his letter home, he's reading it in bed with Mrs. Slater, and she reads the letter, and she goes, oh, it's Tom. Bloody hell, he'd be quite good as Doctor Who. And he goes, oh, I suppose so. He goes, oh, look, there's a letter here. It says he's skint and he's available for work.
I'm a trained actor reduced to the status of a bum.
So he then goes back in on Monday morning, wherever, and he says, oh, I've got a brilliant new name for it. How about Tom Baker? Well, I don't know him. Oh, it's great. Get a load of stuff down the RSC. Fantastic for me in the Millionaire's. You know, I think he's great. So they start looking him up, and that's when they notice he's in Golden Voyage of Sinbad, and everything just comes together. It's literally, he said, I can't believe how lucky I was. He said, if that letter arrives a week later or a couple of days later, he said, nothing comes together. It doesn't work.
Yeah, and we're lucky as well.
Well, you're very lucky. Otherwise, you'd just had some random 90-year-old bloke signing art prints to go with your Hinchcliffe book. And people be going, what? Haven't you got Mr. Pastry's signature?
Well, this is true. But do you know what's weird? If it had turned up later, I still think they'd have found a part for Tom on Doctor Who, but it would have been as a guest part. And it's interesting to think who it would have been, you know, Tom would have been really good as, say, I don't know, Noah in the Ark in Space or...
Well, I mean, in a weird way, because he played a really good Rasputin, didn't he? You can imagine him as the Master.
The Master would be great.
And sorry, Mr. Ainley, but...
Well, it could have been Hieronymus, couldn't he?
I think Hieronymus would have been amazing, yeah. They'd have found something for him, but you're the Master. So you never know, in an alternate universe, or, you know, lovely Magnus, hooty old Magnus Greel, you know, as Tom Baker. It's a delicious what if. So weirdly, maybe I would be getting an art print signed by Tom, but it would just be because he's the last surviving cast member in Mask of Van Bragger or something like that.
Yeah, imagine if he'd been the Doctor instead of that Mr. Pastry.
Yeah, they'd say, oh, God, yeah, he was in the mix for Mr. for the Doctor, but, oh, you know, beat him to the punch.
Mr. Pastry. In a way, looking at him, you can sort of see their thinking.
Can you?
Like, if they decided to go, OK, we're going to go back to Hartnell, So dodgy old man being mischievous, but having an Ian Chesterton and Harry Sullivan. So it kind of makes logical sense. But then if he was, then if he really didn't get the concept and he was going to play him as a Mr. Pastry character.
Yeah, I can't get the image of Mr. Pastry staggering out of the Dalek incubator room with one of those little Dalek embryos around his neck. Ooh! Oh, no! Do I have the right?
Yeah, it's very much Where's Me Washboard, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not questioning them using an older actor. Just saying, why would they choose someone from the bottom of the list instead of from the top of the list of older actors?
Well, it's sort of following. It is following from Pertwee, because I suppose when Pertwee takes over, he's a comedy actor. He's never played anything, as far as I can see, remotely.
Yeah, but he may be a comedy actor. He's not a fool, though, is he? No, I don't mean a bloody fool. I mean, he's not.
No, I know what you mean.
A fool.
Hmm.
I mean, he clearly thought that he was going to play as a Mr. Pastry character, but I suppose. You know, had he had a bit more about him in those interviews, he'd have seen pretty quickly. I mean, how active is the Doctor in that first season, I suppose? You know, you've got Ark in space. I mean, Harry could handle all the thumping that's there. A lot of it's sort of big speeches and...
Can I admit something to you? I've never seen a single second of Mr. Pastry, so...
No, nor have I.
I have no idea whether he's a good actor or not, but he seemed to have some sort of huge career. So could he feasibly have acted not like his Mr. Pastry character, but like his version of the Doctor? Maybe he would have actually blown people away.
Well, what he's missing, as far as I can see, is a sort of this sporting life Hartnell role. Because, yeah, I can see the argument against Hartnell is that, yeah, he's a bit of a has-been and been grunting Sergeant Major for Granada TV for the past 4 years. Seems a bit one-note, and I suppose... That would have been the argument against until they see the sporting life and they go, oh, crikey, he's actually quite good. So, yeah, maybe he'd done do you remember Arthur Atkinson, Where's My Washboard? When they flash forward to later in his career when he's doing, like, Weird Play for Today's.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe there's a kind of, you know, a Richard Hearn grim play for Dennis Potter play for today somewhere. In there, that would have gone, oh Christ, he's quite good. I don't know.
I was just looking at his Wikipedia now, and his filmography, his first role in 1934 is as Drunk in Give Her a Ring, and then Acrobatic Drunk in 1935's Dance Band. So he just seemed to have only been in comedies.
Well, anyway, there we go. The pastry era of Doctor Who that was not to be.
It was in Passport to Pimlico. No, as Nighttime Drunk on Bike.
This book of yours, what do the chapters within it comprise?
So, yeah, so what we have, I mean, we do have some people you may have heard of. So, spanning 188 pages, although I think that is likely to grow because we've added another essay since then. So, Introduction by Louise Jameson.
Oh, wow.
We have The Hinchcliffe Years by Toby Haydock, which is really just a sort of where was Doctor Who when Philip arrived, what was working, what was the context. So it's good stuff, well written. We have Dr. Matthew Sweet on the Ark in Space, considering morality and politics during the Hinchcliffe Years. We have Sophie Morphew, who looks at the use of old monsters during the Hinchcliffe Years, which is the Sontaran experiment, which is, yeah, it's an interesting topic, that, because Philip often refers to that first season as, yes, it was set up for me by Barry, but Daleks and Cybermen, you know, they were the comfort blanket. They were there to stop people from going, oh, it's not John Pertwee anymore, this is rubbish. Who's this bloke? You know, so there's a lot to dig into. Gentles of Daleks, Alex Kingdom, now, this was a replacement, what we originally had planned, and then Russell went and did something that really... You know, made it. So it's about disability representation and villainy in Doctor Who and beyond. So that looks at basically, is Davros being a wheelchair bound supervillain? Is that a bad thing? Is that a difficult thing? How does it sit within the program? And that's been brought right up to date after, you know, we have a new Davros who's not in the chair now and all the debate around that. So that's a good chunky piece. Hannah Cooper, who is, a brilliant, I think she's Mrs.
Mrs. Simon Templar?
Mrs. Simon Templar, that's right. She's great fun.
On Twitter, she's not actually married to the saint.
She would love to be, I'm sure. As we all would be. So she's done a piece around Renger Simon, which is where Doctor Who stood as a VT in film series in the 70s. And it's a really technical, granular, deep dive. There's lots to dig into if you are a fan of how television was made in the 70s. Very clever. Tim Pfeiffer-Adams, brilliant American fan, because Gary Russell was keen to get fans from all around the world. Why was this the era that America finally bought into Doctor Who? Which is interesting, because I'd always thought that Doctor Who goes big in America more or less with the Graham Williams era and all that sort of witty Douglas Adams stuff. But apparently not. Hinchcliffe is what got them hooked on Doctor Who and was the result of probably hundreds of PBS viewing drives, you know, forevermore. Our good friend Simon Gurrier talks about Planet of Evil, which is borrowing from the sci-fi classics, which it does exactly what you expect. So it's starting to look at where Bob Holmes, what his ideas factory was, but also Philip Hinchcliffe. You know, when we were around, I was around Philip's house, and you look at his bookshelves in his study, he's a serious sci-fi reader, you know, Asimov, all of those guys, like serious intellectual sci-fi. That was his thing. Now, there's a bloke who I've never heard of called Hayden Gribble.
No, nothing.
Oh, I think that's Mr. Sophie Gribble.
Oh, yes, oh.
Not the actual one, of course, only on Twitter.
He's just called the Procreator.
Oh, dear.
He's writing about possession as a recurring theme, which, you know, it does happen a lot in the Hinchcliffe era. Yes, you know, the old Sarah Jane is routinely possessed, hypnotised. I would imagine Sarah needed a lot of help. Perhaps she got in Aberdeen. Kenny Smith, lovely Kenny Smith, who does the brilliant, all that stuff with the fanzine stuff with Big Finish. So he's brilliantly looking at Hinchcliffe's own unmade stories and his Big Finish work. Mick Schubert, this was a good essay actually on Brain of Morbius, which is real science versus fantasy science. So again, this is a little bit of you get a hint of the difference between where Hinchcliffe is sometimes coming from and where Holmes is coming from. You know, Holmes talks a good game, but he's proper hammer, you know, in his take on things. And Hinchcliffe is a little bit more serious. Seeds of Doom, looked at Phillips' Target novel. So that's David Howe. He knows everything about Target novels.
Hang on, Hinchcliffe's a little bit more what?
Science.
All right.
Philip will tell you quite honestly that, you know, where he came from, that he wasn't a Hammer horror guy.
Mm.
But he picked up on that quite quickly. And Bob was, you know, Bob loved all the universal horror from the 30s all the way up to, you know, and I'm sure there's a bit of work to be done around the scheduling of those Friday night horror double bills on BBC Two in the 70s and what is then subsequently written and commissioned a few weeks later or a few months later. I'm sure Bob sat there with a nice, you know, a nice malt whiskey, little notepad and a blazing rough shag in his, you know, in his pipe to keep him going through a double bill of Hammer goodness. And it's nice that it's nice to explore those points because, you know, Philip always talked about him and Bob as being the perfect team, but they're looking at things differently, and I think that's where the strength comes.
So that was Mick Schubert, sorry.
Followed by David Howe looking at Philip's Target novels, which, you know, is interesting. You know, it's to be honest, they're just a little cash job for Philip in between production, in between seasons. They're interesting, you know, because everyone forgets that Philip's background is writing. That's where he started. Writing, script editing. So that's where I think the relationship works with Bob Holmes. Yeah, so Robin Ince on The Master Mandragora. This was...
The Robin Ince.
The original brief was to talk about how Hinchcliffe does historicals. And apparently he just sacked that off in the first three lines and then talked about how Doctor Who speaks to children and how it fires the imagination of children. But that's a really clever essay. Really clever. There's some other bloke who's written on The Hand of Fear called Ian Winston. And do you want to introduce your essay?
Yeah. Well, my brief was to basically concentrate on companions starting with the fact that it's Sarah Jane's exit. So that's kind of the jumping off point. So I explore how Sarah Jane in Hinchcliffe changed from how she was under Letts and with Pertwee. And then I also go into a sort of basically a love letter to Leela, who I do think is the best Doctor Who. Just not just because obviously a lot of it's to do with Louise Jameson, but I also think Leela is so well designed as a character because she simultaneously brings the Doctor up on, you know, calls him on his bullshit, but she also needs stuff explaining to her, but without being a pathetic, and she also, she's not a pathetic damsel in distress who just screams a lot. She's hard as nails. And on top of all that, she's from a science fiction idea. So she's a constant reminder you're watching a crazy science fiction show because she's from the far future, even though she's a savage. So she's just so perfectly designed. Before we even get Louise Jameson cast in it, it's a perfectly designed science fiction character for this show.
You're right, and they stick with that far future idea. It's not like Peter Purvis's Stephen Taylor, who speaks in his episode about how he's a fighter pilot and then just becomes a bloke from 1966. Yeah, I like Louise, you know, and Leela. It's brilliant. It's bold.
And it's weird because I wonder how much of it was actually intentional, but there are a lot of historicals in this period. So you do always get this bit of sci-fi, not just the time machine landing with an alien from Gallifrey. You also have a far future. You know, I love that little twist on In Talons of Wang Chiang when it's not just the Doctor landing in a Sherlock Holmes story. It's Leela of the Sever team being shown, this is how your ancestors lived, which just gives it that extra frisson.
You carry on, boys. I'm just going to fetch some snacks.
Hey!
We're talking roads not gone, but you know, first choice. I remember Philip telling me the first choice for Leela was All Creatures Great and Small's Carol Drinkwater.
Oh, right.
It just seems insane that we look at, you know, the character of Leela. So, somewhere out there in time and space is Dr. Pastry and her from All Creatures Great and Small. It's insane.
Just can't imagine it. But that's because Louise Jameson really just, she nails it, but there's a reason she works loads. And she's, you know, without Doctor Who, she'd have a career. She's not just, oh, I was lucky when I was young, I landed a Doctor Who role. And then, you know, like a lot of people, then their career doesn't quite sustain. She is still going strong. She's in her 70s now, isn't she?
She certainly doesn't dial it in at any point. So, yeah, I love Leela.
Yeah, I
thought, you know, and burn me at the stake here, I've always thought Sarah Jane's a little bit overrated. Chemistry with Tom aside, I always think there's a character, there's not much to her.
Mark, come and help me sweep up this Lalique dish of caviar, would you please?
Royal Beluga, north of the Caspian.
Not off the floor, Ian. We're not in Manchester now.
No, I mean, obviously I do really like Sarah Jane, but I'd still take Leela and Second Romana over Sarah Jane in terms of characters.
Oh, God. The second?
I love Lala Ward's Romana. I'm sorry, I don't care who knows it.
No, so do I.
Funny enough, I'm halfway through watching Stones of Blood at the moment, and I'm really enjoying what Mary's on.
Well, she's great as well. You know, we are spoiled for choice.
They're all pretty good. In fact, all of those 70s companions, they've got a Duff one in there.
There's a world of difference between admiring an acting performance and wanting the actress to sit on your face.
You just woke your mother up again.
Is there a post-watershed cut that you do?
Diddly dumb after dark.
We're always after dark. We're never in the daylight.
Let me finish my big list of essays up.
Yeah.
So we've got Matty Topolow, who I think does the Review of Death, doesn't he? He's talking about the Deadly Assassin, so he's the use of Doctor Who's heritage. It's a fair thing to talk about with Deadly Assassin because that is the first time in Hinchcliffe's era where suddenly it's like, oh yeah, here's the thing that is actually like A-level Doctor Who and you've got to have knowledge of X, Y, Z. But we're setting the law down for how the Time Lords are going to be perceived and considered forever after this. It's quite an un-Hinchcliffian thing, I think. Face of Evil by Trey Corte is looking at faith and belief, which I think, you know, again, it's an interesting Face of Evil it is about faith, but seen through a sci-fi prism, which is, tends to how they do it. Robots of Death. This one I'm looking forward to, actually. This is a late edition when we shuffled the deck, so you get an extra essay. This came out of a chat that I had with lovely Simon Gurrier, where we were talking about design during the Hinchcliffe era, and in particular, how Roger Murray Leach and Jim Acheson just dovetailed. And he was talking at length about, well, this was the only time in the show where this unified theory of design had actually been really pulled off. You know, the idea that makeup, costume, set design,
yes,
all complements. And so that one I'm looking forward to, actually. I think that's going to be... Because Phil...
I don't know, what, Ark in Space?
No, not just the Robots of Death. I mean, during the Hinchcliffe era.
Oh, I see, sorry, yeah.
There's a move towards it. It's the only time really it happens, you know, because the Williams era is a bit more of a dog breakfast when it comes to design and costume, and it is fighting against each other, whereas this is unified. So... Mm. Phil's got a set design and a costume design background that's going to be good. And then we've got Talons Wen Chang by Emma Coe, who is, she's heavily involved in the Southeast Asian and Asian community, involved with equity. And so she's looking, so we have Grasp Nettle here, the Talons, and she hadn't seen Talons Wen Chang. So she looked at this as a person of that ethnicity and just said, what does this say about the industry at the time, about television at the time, and have we really come that much further in Doctor Who or not?
That does sound like an interesting
take. You know, that's the one where I thought, if any of these essays have got the potential to upset Philip, that's the one.
Well, I was going to say, Philip thought that was great, didn't he?
He loved that. You know, he thought it was really good and interesting. And then the final is an afterword, which is what Philip did after Doctor Who, which is by Matt Dale, who sadly lost on Christmas Day. It was quite a shock.
Oh, no.
Lovely guy, lovely fan. Proper fan writer, lovely guy. So this is his last piece of published work that will be in there. And after all of these essays, we get some of Philip as well, because we've got 25 hours of new Philip interviews to draw on. So after each essay, Gary has pulled together, you know, relevant stuff that reflects what was said in the essay. And, you know, Philip's reviewing it all as we speak. He's reviewed the entire manuscript. He's given notes on essays. He's given copious notes. You know, and that to me is the DNA of Doctor Who, of the Philip Hinchcliffe era. It's absolute exacting attention to detail. Nobody phones anything up on Philip's watch. Nothing. Everything is exact and considered. And, you know, as he said, you know, his job was to just make everyone raise their game, and Christ, he's made us raise our game, that's for sure. So it's going to be a good piece.
Fantastic. I take it there's no pieces that mention Mary Whitehouse in there, is there? Because last time I saw Philip being interviewed, the interviewer mentioned Mary Whitehouse, and the look on Philip's face was just, not again.
Philip is the kind of guy who you can't just shove into the end of a day at a convention where they've run out of time and just have an ill-prepared interviewer, you can tell I've seen this happen, who just shouts out 20 minutes worth of questions. Was Tom Baker great to work with? Is Bob Holmes a genius? And isn't Mary Whitehouse horrible? And they just say, tell us more of how much of a genius, you know, Tom Baker is. And, you know, you can see he's thinking, God, I've given up a day to do this. And then Mary Whitehouse, you know, did she get you sacked? You know, and that's it. And I thought, although we did originally have an essay planned that was going to look at this, but the writer wasn't available. And that was going to be on Genesis of Daleks. And this is where Alex then came in and looked at disability representation, which is far more interesting than Mary Whitehouse. But I guess Whitehouse boils down to, yes, she was a colossal pain in the arse. Yes, there was something behind it that was sort of fundamentally Christian. Yes, the BBC kind of kept her on the outside. Yes, Philip probably did go a bit far. Yes, the sixth floor panicked and let her in. And once they'd let her into the kingdom, they could never get rid of her.
What was it that Bill Cotton said to all the to everyone in the BBC about Mary Whitehouse? Always be polite, but never let her in the building.
Well, it's also the Mary Whitehouse stuff's just been covered over and over and over elsewhere anyway. So I doubt there's much new to say about it, to be honest. Whereas it sounds like the replacement essay is a lot more pertinent and a lot more relevant and a lot newer.
What I like about it is it's obviously concentrating on Hinchcliffe, but it does go, this is within the history of Doctor Who, this thing that's still going.
There's an extra on the Pyramids DVD, which is about a 40-minute talk about Philip Hinchcliffe's era. And you know, sometimes they do, and so-and-so wrote a letter too, and they'll go into the BBC's document archive, and they'll actually show you the physical letter they've got. It's this letter from Mary Whitehouse, and it's on National Viewers and Listeners Association headed notepaper. And all down one side at the top is the names of all the, you know, directors and patrons of the Mary Whitehouse's association. And they're all Major General, the Honourable blah blah blah, Indian Army retired, the Right Reverend, the Suffragan Bishop of Tytar, stuff like that. It's really, really bizarre.
Yeah, it's a strange setup, but I mean, she does change Doctor Who, no doubt. You know, after the Deadly Assassin, it's not long that Philip's moved. Graham Williams comes in. Graham is told this has got to be lighter in tone, although it clearly takes him a few months to get that memo. And what we tried to do is not do the obvious, and try and find something new to say. And I think you're both quite right. There's very little that's new to say about Mary Whitehouse. And it's really down to whether you thought her critique was fair game. I mean, I don't know. I think my mum, I'm just on the cusp of the Hinchcliffe era. My very first memories are the Deadly Assassin.
Oh, right. Youngster.
I know. But I don't think my mum was really watching it. So I think, had we been sat there, because my mum and dad, we had a hotel. So when Doctor Who was on, most of the time they were working.
Yeah.
So they plonked me in front of the telly watching. Would my mum have been happy about little Gareth watching Harrison Chase being fed to the shredder and that blood-curdling, chilling scream?
Sorry, that was only me. I just got a paper cut leafing through my notes. Were all the guests in the hotel lounge saying, do we have to watch Doctor Who every Saturday?
We watched it downstairs on, I mean, this is true minutiae. So we did have a colour TV, but that was upstairs, sister's lounge. We had a black and white set downstairs, but during the winter, we would bring the colour TV down and live as kings. So we would watch half the year in colour and then the rest of the year in black and white until we finally got a colour set.
Could you do that in a moment, please?
I'm on the telephone.
But you haven't finished dialing yet, have you? Now, listen. There is a documentary on BBC Two this evening about Squawking Bird, the leader of the Blackfoot Indians in the late 1860s. Now, this starts at 8:45 and goes on for approximately three quarters of an hour.
I'm sorry, are you talking to me?
Indeed I am, yes. Now, is it possible for me to reserve the BBC Two channel for the duration of this televisual feast?
No, it isn't.
What?
It is not possible to reserve the BBC Two channel from the commencement of this televisual feast until the moment of the termination of its ending. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, might I suggest then that you introduce such a scheme?
No.
Well, we lost Philip Hinchcliffe, but we could have lost the whole BBC if Mark's mum had written to Mary Whitehouse saying, my son watched Terror of the Zygons, and he couldn't even get out of bed to go for a pee. That was a real catamaran of a story, that, wasn't it, Mark?
Yeah, it was. That's, the big two-boater.
A two-huller.
Funny, actually, my earliest TV memories, apart from some random kind of weird, I think it must be a Harryhausen film that I must have watched when I was like about two or something. Most of my memories of television, my earliest memories were all little snapshots from the Hinchcliffe era.
Mm.
Up until we get into the Graham Williams era in about 79, when I, you know, my fandom and my my memories of it become much more solid suddenly. But loads of odd memories from the Hinchcliffe era, just like of Sontaran's head deflating and stuff like that. Yeah.
I don't actually remember it, but I remember the effect of it, of Terror of the Zygons, because we had a downstairs toilet, which had these sort of very 70s bright orange curtains. So even in the daylight, I was terrified of that place because it reminded me of the Zygon spaceship. So I always said my first thing, because I remember watching The Root and going at the lighthouse and screaming at the TV and my mum turning it off. And then I screamed even louder as my mum had to turn it back on to make me stop.
Fancy being scared of something like the Zygon spaceship interior. Be a man, Ian. Oh, who's that at the door? Oh, pizza delivery. Thank you. Let's just see if they've got the topping right. Ah! Oh, sorry, I just had a flashback to 1975.
Yeah, so Horror Fang Rock, which is obviously the next season, Williams, but definitely Zygons when I must have been about three. I definitely saw it because it wasn't repeated crazily or anything, was it? Like much later or anything?
Oh, I remember chatting to Gary Russell actually at the Capitol about Terror of the Zygons and how much it had terrified me and that thing of possession and, you know, people not being who they appeared to be or, you know, the possessed mind. Gary looked disgusted when I mentioned about having to go to the toilet in my plastic boat because the Zygons had scared me so much.
In fact, I seem to remember that Gary was so disgusted, he said, I don't want to talk about this. Hayden, write me a chapter on possession in Doctor Who, will you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's a special surprise for you, Mark, because there's a whole paragraph about you.
Well, in the unlikely eventuality that Philip is listening to this... I think he was a central pillar of my childhood. His era would have lasted from me being, say...
25?
8 until 10, which I imagine is possibly the optimum period for being my doctor. And I refuse to accept anyone who says, oh, those of you who call it the golden age, you just, you know... It's only because you were at the right age at the time. I still don't think it's been beaten.
So, Doctor Who lucks out because, I mean, I was thinking about this. So, Verity is an outside. She's an outside. It's her first job at the BBC.
Yeah.
She comes from, you know, she comes from ATV. She comes from small, entrepreneurial, fast-moving ITV companies where you can be promoted very quickly and youth and talent wins out. Philip does exactly the same. You know, he comes from doing Crossroads and other dramas, famously turning down On the Buses for ATV. But, you know, again, so he's an outsider. He comes in the BBC. He's not working his way up. And after Philip, they're all guys who are already at the BBC. They're into, you know, it's just an internal, not a promotion. After Verity, you know, God, it's a right, you know, random collection of people moving in and out. You know, it's like, you know, one point in the Troughton era, it's like Tory prime ministers where you've got a new one every 6 months. So it's we are lucky, you know, and I think there's a reason that his era stands out. That's why we picked it for the first in the series.
Yeah, and I'd say about the golden era bit, I was the wrong age for Hinchcliffe. I came online as a human for Williams, but it was I still think it was the absolute golden age. It was, you know, you look back now and you watch it and it, whatever you think about Horns of Nymon and everything, it's definitely, it takes a dip after Talons. There's a definite drop in everything.
The golden age definitely stretches from Robot to Talons of Wang Chiang. And there's a brief blip several years later during Horns of Nymon. But Philip's era covered 17 stories, and I think 8, possibly 9 of those are among the ultimate greats.
Yeah, I can watch the whole era through, no problem, which I can't say about any other part of Doctor Who, I don't think.
They always have something in there. There's something, you know, Philip could be quite down on Revenge of the Sidemen sometimes. He goes, well, yeah, you know, that one. He said, I took my eye off the ball. But he said, I was putting everything into Genesis of Daleks at the time, and I knew that Michael Bryant would do a solid job. But he said, the script wasn't good, and, you know, it's not our best work, but I think it's still okay.
I still really enjoy it. I watched You know, as I think we've alluded to or mentioned, that I rewatched Brain and Morbius earlier on today, and it's just absolutely outstanding. It's just so good all the way through. It's perfect, and I think a lot of the Hinchcliffe era is of a similar standard. You know, even if it's Mrs., which, like you said, Revenge of the Cybermen, or is some of the more middling ones, you know, like Mask of Mandragora, and or even Planet of Evil. You know, there's still really good stories. They're still really enjoyable. There's great Doctor Who still.
Yeah, they've still got ambition baked into it. You know, and I think that's, you know, and again, that's what we discovered. Philip is all about the detail. He's all about stretching and making things as good as they can be. And that's why his era is so revered. And yes, there's highlights after that, but they seem to be accidents. You know, I mean, you've got Case is a fabulous piece of television, but it's followed by The Twin Dilemma. You know,
yeah,
it's almost like the quality almost happens by accident after that, or in isolation.
It's like you're saying about, you know, you're saying about the design and the costumes and everything during this era seems to be, it all folds in together for each story. And I wonder if that's it, because the whole era, as a matter of quality, seems to fold into me. I think, as you were saying earlier, was it you, Gareth, was saying, I think we were lucky with, like, Verity and that. But I think, in a way, we were lucky that it's not, oh, this is Hinchcliffe's era and that's why it's brilliant, or this is Tom's era, or this is Bob Holmes's era as the story editor. It's the fact that the three of them happened to come together at the same time, and with, you know, great companions like Ian and Louise and Liz. But, yes, it's actually, it was Bob Holmes that had the horror fixation, whereas Philip was more of the, as you were saying, the slightly more intellectual science fiction, science fantasy thing, wasn't he? But the fact that they melded together so well, and I also think that what we've heard so much about at Capital, was it last year or the year before, about how Russell, during his period as showrunner in the modern era, has rewritten far more and to a far greater extent than is generally admitted, so much of the stories. And I think in this era, Bob Holmes was often almost wholly rewriting some of the stories.
Yeah, yeah.
From page one. And we don't think, if we say, oh, which stories did Robert Holmes write? We think, oh, well, he darkened space, didn't he? But you could possibly say a great deal of all 17 of these stories.
It's easier to pick out the ones he hasn't done a huge job on. So Genesis of the Daleks.
Yeah.
I mean, Philip's always quite honest about that. He says that's 90% Terry Nation with a good 10% Bob Holmes polish.
Yeah.
So yes, that one isn't him, but yeah. And I've got a feeling that Planet of Evil is probably mostly Louis Marks. But yeah, you're right. I mean, when you go beyond there, you know, the ones where he's really getting stuck in because the scripts aren't right. They aren't what he wants them to be. And Philip always says, you know, he said, I was lucky because I could walk in and go, oh, this isn't very good. Sorry, Bob, it's a page one rewrite. He said, he'd just do it. Maybe we all have a Bob Holmes when we're in the ship.
Yeah.
Indeed. Do you still have tears left to sell by that? I don't mean start crying and saying, please buy the Hinchcliffe book, but pledging tears on the Hinchcliffe book.
Now, this is something brand new. So, you know, people who don't know what we do with Cutaway is everything is based around doing an initial Kickstarter, which raises the money. Otherwise, these things don't happen. And as part of that, we, you know, we have merchandising tiers where you get lots of extra goodies and lots of different things. So that Kickstarter in November did very, very well. But we tried something different. We can keep the campaign open on Indiegogo, like a legacy page. So if you haven't sold all the packages, and we've still got some packages left, and they sell, you know, they've done all right since they did that. So you can still back it on Indiegogo, and I'm sure you lovely people will put the link in the notes. And yeah, we've still got, I think, 15 of the top packages, producer. We sold out of Head of Series and Serials in about an hour, which was the really super deluxe. But this is still lovely. The main thing you get with this is a Will Brooks art folio of, I think, 18 or 19 prints. And most of those are signed by someone, including lovely Tom Baker, who I got those signed at his house down in the southeast 3 or 4 weeks ago. I didn't meet Tom himself, but I had a lovely couple of chats with Mrs. Tom, who is a delight. Yeah, she's lovely. And it's funny, this is how rumours work, you know. I said, someone we both know, I won't know, I'll to spare his blushes, dropped me a line to say, oh, how is Tom? I hear he's a mess since his wife died. And I thought, well, I'm pretty sure she's not dead, because I had a cup of tea with her. And if she is dead, no one's mentioned it to her. And there was a whole rumour going round, which I think is a conflation of Tom's beloved dog died.
Yeah.
That's about that. And people had gone, had mixed up dog for wife. So anyway, yeah, so lots of lovely stuff to buy and DVDs full of commentaries. We're recording Seeds of Doom, brand new commentary on Monday. And then there's Talon's Wen Chiang left to do, which is brilliant.
And a brand new announcement the boys are able to make is that if you contribute £1,000, you'll have access to a piece of software where, regardless of what you use, Amazon Music, Spotify, iTunes, download this piece of software and it will block the Diddly Dumb podcast from being on anywhere. So, hang on. The cutaway site is crashing already.
Oh, gosh.
So, obviously, we'll put all this stuff in the show notes at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com. But what do people do? Just go to Cutaway Comics?
Yeah, come see our stuff. And we've got, I think the next Kickstarter campaign will be in March. And I'm pretty sure, not 100%, but pretty sure that's the next one is going to be our next big, lavish book, which isn't Graham Williams. That's coming after that. The next big lavish book is going to be a gorgeous big book about all of the character options figures.
Oh, cool.
Like Steve Sansweet does for the Star Wars figures. So Gary's editing that, working with some absolutely fantastic collectors. Everything's been beautifully photographed and posed.
Gary's got a few figures, hasn't he?
He does. And honestly, the debate, I don't collect them, I'll be honest. I admire them. I've got about 5 in the bathroom that just look at me when I'm cleaning the tea. It's going to be the ultimate resource for anyone who loves their dollies.
There's been pictures of a new, officially announced, Mavellans, isn't there? I've noticed on Twitter.
Oh, God. I mean, see, I would buy those. Weirdly excited. You know when Moffat brought them back for about 40 seconds?
Yes. Oh, yes, yeah.
They are beautiful things, I've got to say. And I don't know about you guys, but if I'd had access to this weapons-grade Doctor Who toys at the age of 7, I'd have fainted with pleasure. As opposed to just having a terrible Dennis Fisher Tom Baker where the leg fell off on Boxing Day and putting it in the Action Man group.
Are you trying to tell the young people of today that? And they won't believe you.
I mean, I still think, as great as your meeting on the Common DVD is with the latest Warp Warp, I still think you're going to struggle to beat your Weetabix cards free gift.
Oh.
I've still got that Warp Warp in its original envelope it's arrived in, because I thought, if I just take it out and put it on a shelf, these cards are all going to start falling out and I'll never see them again.
I was too late to find out about Warp. Unfortunately, I missed the set. I'm heartbroken, but there we are.
Well, do you know, weirdly, I love my free gift. And I've now done all the free gifts I've ever wanted for bar one. So we started with transfers, then it was Walkabix, then we did the TV-21 Dalek audio, because I'd always just wanted that TV-21 cut-down version of the case. Serial box, I'd always wanted a serial box, so I've done that before. Then we've done animations, I always wanted to do animation. The only free gift I've never done is, and it's very possible, I really want to do a modern recreation of the iconic, authentic Tom Baker Y-fronts.
Tom Baker?
The Doctor Who Y-fronts with Tom Baker on. As long as we're still having fun, we'll keep doing Walk Warp and we'll keep doing comics and we'll keep doing lovely big books as long as we can and while there's things that we want to do.
What do you believe? God. 24 minutes and 10 seconds into our very first episode of Diddly Dumb Podcast, we did a sort of, it must have been like an equivalent of what became known as Rassilon's Horn, where the Rev, oh, that name rings a bell, I wonder who that could be, did a little talk on Tom Baker 9 on Underpants from British Home Stores.
Oh.
Previously until we come.
What were the first pieces of Doctor Who merchandise you ever got?
VHS nylon underpants.
All right.
With Tom Baker's face on them.
A classic.
That's the time last year, wasn't it?
Yes. He used to give you a rash in the summer. They were hot and electrocuted you.
Tom Baker's face on and then I am bigger on the inside.
That's what I used to tell people.
On the zeitgeist, as always.
Yeah. You're going to have to find the right nylon polyester mix that's authentic.
Yeah, well, I think we can do that. We did look, I really wanted to do the Give a Show slides, and we looked very, very, very seriously at trying to get them manufactured, and we just couldn't do it. I wanted to do authentic. I am a bit crackers. And the other thing we're very hard at doing, and we just can't quite do it, it might happen eventually. I wanted to do new sets of Viewmaster reels, and the Viewmaster reels was doable actually. You can get them.
Wow.
Done. But what we couldn't do, or we still haven't been able to do, is I wanted to see if there was a way to do a cardboard flat pack Viewmaster reader, because I've got to be able to post these bloody things. And that we couldn't quite work out. We were close, but we couldn't work out. But yeah, we wanted to do brand new Viewmaster, you know, an unseen dissipation adventure. And we could have hit the Viewmaster treatment.
I've got happy memories of my Captain Kremen Viewmaster.
Oh, that's amazing.
So how goes the Cutaway Bunker podcast?
It's going well. I've just had a double episode with Robert Shearman.
Oh, lovely guy.
Yeah, brilliant. He's so generous with his time.
One of the nicest people I've ever met.
Oh, he just is so nice.
Yeah.
He really is.
And he says that having met me.
I know. But he ended up describing himself. He's so self-deprecating. Everything's like, well, I'm a bit shit. Oh, I don't know how I got this job. I'm like, no, you're not. You're obviously a very talented writer. And he just said, well, it's all just a bit of luck. But then he ended up describing himself. If I ended up becoming showrunner of Doctor Who by some fluke, it would. And he goes on to this lovely long rant about how Doctor Who would be destroyed so utterly and the reputation of Doctor Who would be so in the toilet that everyone would stop being a Doctor Who fan instantly. And more than that, they'd then go and burn everything that had Doctor Who on it, all the old episodes. People would even discover new episodes just to make sure they were burned. And he goes off into all this sort of great thing. And I went, so you'd be like the Liz Truss of Doctor Who showrunners. And he's like, yes. And then I'd go to lots of conventions and say how it wasn't my fault. We've got lots of guests coming up. Emma Reeves, the writer, sometimes a Big Finish, but obviously of lots of other things that aren't Doctor Who, is the next episode. And we've got Gary Russell coming up and various other people. Hopefully Steve Noonan, if I can ever pin him down. But I think he's quite busy at the moment.
Anything coming up regarding the comics? Anything imminent?
Well, there's work is started on the Happiness Patrol. So we've got a script in from Steve Lyons, and it's got a couple of things at the moment. Ian's been working on Drax today.
This very day.
And Iris Wildtime is finished.
Ooh.
So that one's finished. So that's Iris' first comic. It seems bonkers that there's ever been an Iris comic. So that's good. You know, lovely, lovely work on that. And Katie's happy, which makes us happy, because Katie is strangely exacting about how she's depicted. So... is that moment of peril where you go, and this is it. This is what you're going to look like. And she goes, oh, yeah, fine, darling. So, and Inferno is well on its way. The Inferno prequel with John Ridgway on Gary's script. And that will hopefully be followed up fairly quickly by the Inferno, first part of the Inferno series, where Gary gets to destroy the world horribly over three sets of comics. He'll love that. And that's Martin's back as well. Martin Geraghty's returning for that series. So, yeah, I just said to Gary, I said, you've got to look at it globally, but there's no happy ending here. This is going to be pretty horrible. You've got three comics to fill it. So, there we go.
Mark, you asked the boys about Uncle Des, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I was going to say, how's Uncle Des?
Uncle Des, yeah. So Des, I know he was at the DWM 600 party last night. I'm waiting to hear the gossip on that, but he'll have had a ball. I went to see him in Brighton a couple of times this month, and you know, always good fun. He's always got. He doesn't always tell me what I want to hear, but he tells me what I need to hear, and he's bloody good. You know, I'd love to see Des back with a big project. Because he's like a lot of these guys, they're not retired. They just end up being retired because the, you know, the work just ends. But no, Des has got one big project left in it, and I hope you can find it.
Excellent.
Is there anything more that we have to say?
No, I think that's it. It's been pretty exhaustive, hasn't it?
The only thing I could mention is yesterday I was down in London and I've got an audio drama which nothing to do with Doctor Who, but it's set in the 19th century. It's on a canal and it's the money for it has come from Museum of London Archaeology and a big humanities fund, and it's a big engagement thing based on a dig in Rochdale that my wife, who's an archaeologist, has actually done. So it's a really big audio project. And yesterday, I managed to secure some bloke called Christopher Eccleston. So
who?
Yesterday, I was in London.
Who?
I know. He's going to do well, I think. I think he's got a career ahead of him.
I've heard he's a bit of a troublemaker.
Yeah. So I recorded him all his lines yesterday in a studio in Soho.
Oh, brilliant.
In London. And and it was absolutely marvellous. It was like nerve-wracking because I was running the room and directing him and all that, but obviously he was just all business. He was like, right, straight behind the desk, right, let's go, got a lot to do, and we did it with 20 minutes to spare. So it was brilliant nerve-wracking day. And then I had the most perfect sort of way of coming down from that was I sort of told the Big Finish people, you know, Lisa McMullen and Alfie Short, I said I was going to be in around, and they were actually in the area anyway. So I ended up having quite a lot of scoops with them, just going, ah! So just to sort of come down from the stress that I, the enjoyable stress that I'd just been through. And so that was just a brilliant little day in Soho.
Oh, lovely.
Which we're now, it'll be announced very soon. So it's fine it going out on the, your podcast whenever it does.
Links in the show notes. And coincidentally, Christopher Eccleston. He's going to be, we've almost got his agreement to appear as a guest on the Deadly Zone podcast.
Really?
He's only got three conditions. Sack Hayden Gribble, sack Mark John, sack Doc Whom. Now, we've got rid of Hayden, but we'll see how it goes. What's that noise coming from the Hoosium Exhibition Hall? Gareth, have you been pressing any buttons? I don't know, I've not been noticing.
Who, me?
Well, there are only four of us here, and your name is Gareth. What's in there? When you came to us on episode 32 of the podcast and donated two items to the Hoosium, did you lock the display case properly? Computer, could you open the doors to the exhibition hall, please? Oh no, they've got out! It's K9 and Polyphase Avatron having a fight!
Glorious. Oh, well, there we go. You see, some birds are meant to be caged. Their silicate is too bright.
So I think we'd better be going, don't you? Oh, here's Uncle Terence. Uncle Terence, I'm sorry, you better... We're going to have to run, I'm afraid. There's a fight going on.
Shit, we'd all better run. Do not fight in here.
So, goodbye, everyone. Bye from me.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Sorry for coughing so much.
Just top up Gareth's tank before we go.
Oh no! Gareth and Ian have been hit by stray laser blasts. Quick, let's drag their bodies away. Uncle Terence, can you suggest what we do with Gareth and Ian?
Yes, don't dump them into the river. Do not dump bodies into the river.
Uncle Terence, we have battling...
automatons.
Uncle Terence, we have battling automata shooting up the museum.
It's a trap.
See you at Capital, I guess.
Yeah,
we'll be there. It's going to be a good day, as always.
They're alive!
Hooray!
Great to see you guys. Lots of the SIS stuff is on the links. They're all in the show notes, everyone. Ta-ta, everyone. And as ever, faithless listeners, you can find links to photos, videos, and more information on almost everything that we discuss on the Diddly Dum podcast at our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. I don't suppose you have a copy of Warp Warp Volume 2. It is rather old. It's by Gareth and Colin. Yes, I'm trying to buy it for an old friend of mine.
No luck, Dad. Never mind. There's still a few more to try.
Good old Yellow Pages. We don't just help with the nasty things in life, like a blocked drain. We're there for the nice things, too.
You do? Oh, that's wonderful. My friend will be delighted. Can you keep it for me? My name? Yes, it's Doc Hume. Brilliant. I'll be able to flog it for thousands on eBay.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook, and Mastodon at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum, the empty space that circles time.